BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thank you for downloading the Start the Week podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello. Almost every year, there's big flooding stories which dominate the media for a few days and then mysteriously vanish again. This election campaign began, of course, with flooding around Doncaster. But add all of those stories up, remember them, and go back and look at what happened where, and a much more alarming picture emerges. We're going to be talking about how climate change is reshaping this country. Professor David Lerner, an environmental engineer from Sheffield, is here to reveal Britain's hidden rivers and make the case for opening them up, or daylighting them, once more. That should please the journalist Leif Arbuthnot, an enthusiast for so-called wild swimming in rivers, in lakes and in the sea, a practice to which many people, particularly women, are turning to improve their physical and their mental health. Tanya Kovacs, a well-known artist based in Devon, has long been obsessed by our relationship with water, and she's here to discuss how art can begin to help us get our heads around the changing climate. But I want to start today with flooding and the altering shape of the country. Edward Platt's been out talking to drenched communities and observing our rivers and coasts for a book he calls simply The Great Flood, Travels Through a Sodden Landscape. Edward, you've been all over England and Wales in particular, talking to communities. At the end of these journeys, did you come away with a very different view of the country?
Well, I suppose I came away with a view of how vulnerable it is, or all is, or can be, and how anywhere can be affected by flooding, how this strikes without.
And it's absolutely everywhere. You've got a map at the beginning of the book. You know, there's the West Country. We're familiar with Somerset and the problems there, but there's also the East Coast, erosion in particular, but yeah. What's happening to Norfolk and East Anglia in general, yeah. And then up to Yorkshire and indeed Cumbria. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Add them together. Do you think we are going through a period where the entire country is threatened by flooding in a way that hasn't happened before?
Yes. I mean, well, there's no doubt. Climate change isn't a future prospect. It's a present reality. And the climate that I grew up with has changed. Mm. It's gone.
There's a lot to be impressed by in this book. You know, the resilient communities holding together, people really helping each other and all of that. But everywhere you go, there seems to be a great deal of anger directed at the authorities and the Environment Agency in particular. Why is that?
Well, it's the management of water has always been politically contentious. I mean, there's an argument that attempts to manage water were humanity's first attempts at collective engineering. So it's always been politically significant and politically contentious. And people always want someone to blame. So there's a...
It's always going to be the case. And there's a sense, of course, if they help one community, they may be damaging somewhere else.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Water goes where it will in the end.
Yeah, and it's a bit like health service resources. There'll never be enough to go around and people will never be satisfied with how it's allocated. And most people will argue that money spent on flood defences in their neighbourhood is money well spent. Money spent 100 miles up the road is a scandalous waste of public funds. But I was interested to discover that there was a very particular argument about the Environment Agency, which I hadn't expected to hear, which goes back a long way. And there was a recurring story about people believe they've been flooded because someone opened a floodgate. So there's always this sense of someone upstream opened a floodgate.
And often that's simply not true, because you investigated these stories, didn't you?
Often it's not true, but it's a very old fear. There was a lot of land lost on the West Coast. And there's a recurring story about, for instance, there's a kingdom
Wales.
Called...
There's a Welsh story, isn't
the
there?
The Sunken Hundred, which was a kingdom off Cardigan Bay.
Just tell us a little bit about the Sunken Hundred, because I'd never heard of this before.
Well, there's land lost off the West Coast and off the East Coast. I mean, obviously, we used to be connected to continental Europe. Doggerland flooded 8,000 years ago. There was also land lost off the coast of Wales and in the Irish Sea. And this particular kingdom, which they called it a kingdom, it was a territory, a tract of land that were, which flooded 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. There are still the storms 4 years ago unearthed tree stumps. So there was evidence of what used to be there. But there's a folk tale about this land was lost one night because a drunken embankment keeper forgot to close the sluice gate. And further up the coast, there's another story about land being lost because of the the machinations of an evil suitor. So this story goes back, and now the villain has changed. So the villain is no longer...
There's something psychologically interesting here. We want to blame flooding not on the changing climate or heavy rain, but on each other, on some failure of human activity.
Yeah, and that's partly because people always have a local focus, and they don't think globally. They don't think about the changing climate. They think about what's happening in their neighbourhood. And it's also that instinct to blame people, yeah, to want to hold someone to account.
So if we can switch from West Wales to the east coast of England, a lot of people are familiar with Dunwich, this town which is mostly sunk and lots of churches just underneath the water. Yeah. But you suggest in the book that lots of other places, currently very well inhabited and relatively famous places like Aldborough and Southwark, Southwold rather, could be at threat. Yep. And indeed, a lot of the shape of East Anglia, that great big, rather perfect semicircular bulge, will go.
Yeah, well, the east coast is particularly vulnerable because it's low-lying, and sea levels have been rising for a long time, but the rate of rise has increased. Quite how much we will lose depends on unanswerable questions about climate change and the rate at which it progresses.
So in 50 years' time, looking down from space, Britain will be a different shape.
It will, yeah. I mean, parts of the east coast will have gone. There was a terrifying picture, which I didn't include in the book, of Britain. There are many different projections, but one projection of Britain in 2100, and it's an archipelago, a collection of scattered islands.
And there's been lots of talk about the centre of the country becoming a huge lake. I think that goes back to Victorian writers.
Yeah, there was a novel called After London by a Victorian...
Richard Jefferies, yes.
Exactly, he writes about the lake in the middle of England. But
a lot of your book is interviews, conversations with people who have been flooded.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very often impressive people, but in simple terms, what did you learn from them?
Well, the first thing I learned, and actually the first thing I wanted to investigate, was quite why, and this sounds like a strange thing to say perhaps, but quite why flooding is so upsetting. I'd listened to media reports, I'd listened to the interviews from the floods of 2007 and so on. And I was curious... I was struck by the tone of anguish, and I wanted to find out more about that.
David Lerner.
So one of the drivers of flooding in the recent past and near future is the way that land use has changed and the fact that the ground has become so much more impermeable.
Yeah.
Did you get any discussion of whether that was an issue with people?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things people complain about. They will say everyone paves over their gardens, and so there's no
size of fields as well. Fields getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Fewer hedges. Fewer. Mm.
Yeah. So people have theories from the very local up to the.
Tanya Kovitz.
I think there's some very interesting, quite pioneering work going on with the Environment Agency about natural flood defences as well, about kind of re-landscaping rivers, allowing trees to fall across them, working with whole communities that live up and down a river, because a river does form a community, but made up of so many different landowners and invested interests, it's very hard to get a whole river community to work together.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there are some really interesting kind of natural, they call it natural flood management. I think that's just a convenient word for it. But it's just how we live with water, allowing it to flood in certain places and be held up.
It's an argument about what a river is and whether a river is a drain or whether it's a habitat and part of a complex ecosystem.
And there are lots of relatively little known plans to actually surrender territory around Britain. I was up in Hull, and inland from Hull there's a lot of low-lying farmland which has been agreed already will be surrendered in due course. Leif Arbuthnot.
One of the things I was struck by when I was reading your book was this sense of the kind of psychological trauma that people undergo when they get flooded. And actually it reminds me a lot of getting burgled, because I was burgled early in the year, and this sense of the impossibility of your home being invaded.
Yeah.
And when it's a person, I suppose it's a different sort of argument, but it
violation.
Seems that exactly, you know, we think these things happen to other people, and when they do happen to us, it's really disturbing and quite unsettling.
And I think there's a very deep-seated primal fear as well. I think being flooded feels like the end of the world.
Tanya.
And a strange kind of taboo about talking about it. Like once it's happened, there's quite a very, you know, you want to have the clear up as quickly as possible and you want to move on. People don't necessarily want to talk about it afterwards.
No.
I was also impressed by how often people were determined to stay where they had been flooded before, even several times. They weren't going to go away. They weren't going to up sticks.
Yeah. No, well, it's the attachment to home. Yeah, they don't want to leave. And the other curious thing is that even if they're insured and they get their house remade, refitted, exactly as it was before, it doesn't feel like home anymore.
David, let me turn to you now. Your great enthusiasm is for what's called daylighting rivers. In other words, bringing rivers back into the open. Now, they're not in the open in many parts of the country because of culverts. Can you start by explaining culverting?
So, mostly in Victorian times, rivers were buried underground. They built up the land around them, put some walls up, put a roof on top, and turned it into a tunnel. Because sometimes because it smelt so bad, and sometimes because they wanted the land. So where I come from in Bradford, there were no sewers until 1862, but by that stage it was a city of 100,000 people with an enormous number of flak factories, and the river must have been awful. No wonder they covered it up.
Bradbeck, and it was all gurgling underneath Bradford. But there's an awful lot. It's not just Bradford. Sheffield, lots and lots of towns and cities across England and Scotland as well have been culverted.
That's quite right. You look at the map of any city and you can't find water on it, except possibly the really big river like the Thames or the Seine. But everywhere else, you can't find the river. Sheffield has seven rivers running through it. But you can't find them anywhere except the River Don, which is the biggest one and probably too big to cover over. So all cities, I think everywhere.
And of course, well, London's got the Fleet and the Lee and many other rivers underneath it as well. So daylighting is literally breaking the culverts and opening the rivers up.
Yeah.
First of all, why do that?
Well, for lots of reasons. One is that it makes the city a much nicer place. We all love water. If you have a river, you've probably got the cafes, the walks, the parks.
And presumably in these post-industrial times, they no longer stink.
They no longer stink, yes. I mean, if you look at pictures of Bradford, Leeds, Sheffield from the old days, you see the factories backing onto the river, pumping junk into them. Well, now those factories have been converted into modern industrial buildings or into residential or offices. And, of course, they're attractive locations. So we take advantage
of that. So it's partly about beauty and leisure, but it's also about, we were talking about flooding, it's also about controlling the water.
Yes. So Victorian culverts, of course, were sized when the towns were smaller, the cities were less impermeable, the amount of water was an amount. Now the amount of floodwater is probably twice as much because of the expansion of the city, the change in climate, and the number of gardens and roads that have been built. And so the culverts aren't big enough. And if you don't open them up, how are you ever going to get the space for the floodwaters?
So it's an anti-flooding thing, but also I gather that a culverted river, an underground river, is effectively dead.
Yes, nothing lives in there except some very strange...
The lack of oxygen and light.
Well, it's the light. They may or may not have oxygen, depending on how much pollution is getting into the river. But they are dead. The fish aren't going to want to be in there. One of the problems of culverts is it's terribly easy to find them polluted because there may be drains draining into them, often by mistake, but you can't see where they're coming, you can't tell. No one's inspecting it for pollution until you get to the bottom end. And then you've got this smell coming out of the culvert at the downstream end. And where on earth has it come from? Yeah. So, yes, they are dead. You bring them, open them up, bring them back to life, have plants, have fish, have people possibly even paddling or swimming in them.
Now, I know you're really passionate about opening up Bradford, but there's a good example, I think, in Sheffield of Pocket Park.
Yes. So Sheffield's been making great advances. Some long-term enthusiasts in the city council, and they discovered a little opportunity on a small tributary of the Don called the Porter Brook, where they're able to take the lid off the culvert over only probably 100 metres, and then build a little park beside it, like a little amphitheatre facing into it. And what's great about that is you can then take developers and show them, look, this is what could be on your site when you redevelop it. And just having a local example makes a huge difference.
And in terms of non-local examples, I think Zurich is meant to be one of the most successful cases of a city which has opened up lots of its historic and traditional rivers.
So Zurich's an interestingly different example because they've focused on quite small streams, many of which have been put into sewers and drains rather than into culverts. And they're keen to get things which might only be a couple of feet wide back out onto the surface, running through gardens, running alongside roads. And one of the reasons they've done that is that they have been able to show that if you put clean water in a sewer and it goes to the sewage works, it pushes up the cost of treatment because you're treating what is effectively diluted sewage. You're having to build a bigger works, spend more money. So they've realised there's actually just a very straightforward cost to not daylighting. And then they get the joy of having the rivers back.
Another daft laddie question, as we say in Scotland. How do you know where the rivers are? Is it always easy to find to spot the traditional historic rivers that have been hidden under cities and towns?
So the culverts are usually known because somebody is somehow responsible for them. And you can go back to the old maps and you can usually find them. I mean, sometimes you follow the parish boundary on the map and you can tell where the river used to be and it's a different place from where it is now because somebody's wanted to build a railway and they've moved the river sideways.
You're looking for a particularly dank basement.
Yes, well, that's right. You do get them. Mm. There's a basement in Sheffield in a pharmacy, not in Sheffield, in Bradford, in a pharmacy where they tell us they can hear the Bradford Beck running behind the wall. Wonderful example.
Very, very complicated to do this, however, when you've got buildings over the culvert and over the land.
So when I started on this, I assumed that the rivers would run down the streets and there'd be a lid on top. Actually, they run under buildings. And it's because people wanted to build on as much flat land as they could. And they thought, let's put a roof on the river, I can build another building.
Just coming back to you for a second, Edward, talking about building. We've had a lot of discussion in this country about we must stop building on floodplains, we must stop building on easily flooded land. Yeah. Is there any evidence that we're actually doing that at all?
I don't think so. And we've always built on floodplains. We've always built on flooded land. I mean, most of London is on a floodplain. Hmm. And that was one of the things that annoyed a lot of people, especially in the Somerset Levels, who were told you shouldn't live on a floodplain. And they say, well, people who live in London tell us that. And especially with the pressure on the southeast. I think we're still.
But this is not something we can put off for very long because a lot of these Victorian culverts, beautiful brick constructions, as the Victorians did, are now finally falling to pieces.
Well, yes. So I keep going back to Bradford, of course, because I know it best. But the culvert under Bradford has been rebuilt at least three times. So there's a masonry construction for Victorian times, a 1950s brick structure, and a 1970s concrete structure.
Yes. Tanya?
I think there's probably a contribution we've yet to hear from the insurance industry about climate change and what's coming, because there will come a point when we can't insure against the issues we're talking about. And yet they determine a lot of our financial markets and determine where flood defences are built because their modelling is the modelling that gets used to make those decisions. Yeah.
Isn't this such a more interesting conversation than 9/10 of what's going on in the election campaign? Now, David, you were talking about opening up these rivers partly for paddling and you said swimming. And I turn now to Leif Arbuthnot. You are a great enthusiast for what people now call wild water swimming or wild swimming. Many of us of a certain age just think of it as swimming, albeit outdoors. Now, this has become something that's become more and more popular recently. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so there's a survey that's shown that about 490,000 people in November last year went swimming outside, so in a lake or a loch or a river or anything outdoors. And that's a massive increase on the year before. So in 2017, there were 260,000 people.
So what's going on?
Well, I mean, I see it amongst my friends. I'm 27 and a lot of women, particularly I know, are finding real mental kind of solace in going out and getting into very cold water and spending time in nature. I think we all, a lot of young people live in cities. And so there's been a kind of growing alienation from nature, and but there's been this kind of growing awareness as well that swimming outside is a way of reconnecting to the natural world. And I found that living in London, swimming in the Serpentine in Hyde Park.
We'll come on to the Serpentine in a moment because it's a slightly horrific story to me anyway. there's a physical side to this. Immersion in cold water or cold anything is good for the immune system. It's why lots of sports people have ice baths, for instance.
Absolutely. And there are some studies showing that if you swim outside regularly, you're much less likely to get a cold, get the flu, get an infectious disease, often, you know, falls by like 30%. And also I've met lots of people who have found that it's been really good for anxiety, for depression. Obviously, it doesn't work in all cases. And, you know, people who are on medication shouldn't just come off it if they go swimming in a river every water, week yeah. or so. But yeah, studies showing that swimmers experience less fatigue and more kind of vigour and generally happier with their lot, which doesn't really surprise me at all. There was a YouGov poll this year that said that 1.4 million swimmers said that swimming outside had a positive impact on their mental health. And I've certainly found that, that it's really been beneficial for me.
Now, we have an image now of Leif floating down from one of David's daylit rivers. But you do this all the year round. You're
quite
hardcore, aren't you?
Yeah. So I'm swimming. I mean, I didn't go swimming this morning, but I am swimming about five times a week. And it's very cold. It's about, in the Serpentine right now, it's about 2.6 degrees. So we're not quite, you know, cracking the ice yet on the surface of the lake. But it is chilly. And there's nothing harder in my day than getting into that cold water. And that's one of the brilliant things about it, that, you know, you can't have a more scary, difficult moment than the one straight in, the, you know, early in the morning when you get in. But it's also gorgeous. So I love it.
Is that part of the mentally inspiring effect, that you've done something, you've started your day doing something really hard?
Yeah, I think it is. But also, I'd say I'm probably somehow chemically addicted to it now, because I get this feeling afterwards where my skin is, it's sort of on fire and I'm sort of shaking and shivering. And it's really intense. And I also get, you know, a big endorphin rush. So, I'd say that also plays into it. But, you know, I never, ever thought that I would be able to swim in this sort of water. I'm not an outdoorsy person. I'm not sporty. I'm not like hardy. And so the fact that I'm doing this now is really strange. And all my family and friends find it really odd because they know me well.
Just looking on so-called social media and so on, it seems to me that this is much more something that women are enthusiastic about than men. I mean,
yeah.
I don't have percentages, but that's my impression. Again, why do you think that might be?
I think sometimes women, they are quite, you know, sometimes more mentally strong than men, not always, but our bodies are quite good at enduring pain. And there have been, you know, various studies that show this. So, for instance, there was that amazing swimmer, Sarah Thomas, who earlier in the year swam across the channel four times and was pictured
bonkers.
At the end, yeah, with a glass of champagne and or maybe she was having some sweets. So there are studies that show that, you know, that women have a particular type of fat, but also I think that makes them more insulated, but also mental endurance. I have actually met a lot of men in their, you know, in midlife who have also taken up swimming. I mean, a lot of them do races and, you know, take it very seriously. But they seem to find that it's, you know, it gives them a sense of purpose and achievement and also a new community, because often the kind of groups that form around lakes, you know, swimming clubs offer a whole new body of, you know, people to get to know and of all ages and all backgrounds. And that's been one of the pleasures of swimming in the Serpentine for me.
Now, for incautious people who are listening and thinking, this sounds terribly glamorous, gorgeous, kind of pure water bubbling through Devon or gorgeous seascapes. Mm. Let's talk about the Serpentine, because it's not very glamorous, is it?
It's
lots
not
of
glamorous.
Dirty birds, lots of bits of filthy plastic, a kind of green soupy texture.
I wouldn't say soupy. I'd say potion. No, the wonderful thing about the water in the Serpentine is that it really changes throughout the year. So in the summer, when it's very warm, and it was very hot this summer, it can get quite thick and sort of little, you know, particles that are in it, and it does require some bravery to swim through. But then in the winter it becomes much clearer and thinner. So that's the water I'm swimming through at the moment. But you know, yes, you're swimming with ducks and swans, and I've witnessed some terrible scenes where, for instance, a seagull came and carried off a chick on a nest that I was admiring. So it's brutal. I mean, nature isn't just pretty.
It's like the worst bits of the David Attenborough film.
Exactly, the ones they edit out.
So I'm interested that you say that you think you get less illness, because if you talk to surfers against sewage and look at the statistics of people go to bathing beaches, you know, presumably for very casual recreation, not very often, the incidences of gastroenteritis and eye infections is much, much higher.
Yes.
And that's why they are against sewage going into our beaches.
No, so, well, then they should be. I mean, and there was a beach in, I think, California that was that had to be closed fairly recently because loads of sewage was released. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's sewage in the Serpentine. It's actually quite a good body of water.
Except for duck sewage.
Yeah, there is duck sewage. You just have to put up with that, though.
Edward.
My sister, who's also taken up while swimming, tells me she has a rule of thumb, which is she will do a minute for each degree above freezing, which would give you at the moment 3 minutes in the Serpentine.
Well, I have to say somewhat proudly, I'm swimming about 20 minutes at the moment, or 25. I mean, I go very slowly. That's another thing. And I'm, because it's so cold, I wear three hats. So along with swimming gloves and swimming socks. So I do look completely insane.
Gloves, socks and hats. Well, yeah. That sounds a little bit odd.
It is odd.
But it's
and I get people taking
get
photos
coldest.
Of me. Yeah. So people who walk past on the bank, they end up taking pictures. But the body prioritises the heat in the chest. Mm. And so it sort of decides that your toes and your fingers aren't really worth keeping warm when you're in such cold temperature. So your fingers and toes really do get cold.
Now, there may be people listening who are thinking, that sounds great. How do I go about it? Are there swimming clubs, outdoor swimming clubs, open-air swimming clubs all over the country?
There are. And there are also wonderful online resources where there's an outdoor swimming map that I'm sure if you can Google it, and you can enter your postcode and find all the, you know, sort of lakes, rivers around you. And that data has been fed into by swimmers all over the country. And it's wonderful because when I go to my parents' house in Berkshire, I can now find out where the nearest lake is and drive there. I'll be doing that over Christmas when I'm not in London and not able to swim in the Serpentine. And there are plenty of clubs, and they are full of wonderful people. Swimmers are fantastic.
I once went to a Turkish bath, which is a little granite slab, a memorial slab, just above the icy plunge pool for a chap who jumped in and had a huge heart attack. And so they remembered Lenny above it. So the serious point is you don't jump in, you go in slowly.
Yeah, I go in very slowly, and I'm not embarrassed about it. But I would say that if you haven't swum in very cold water before, it's really worth taking time and making sure you're with someone else, because you know the cold water it certainly takes your breath away, and it makes you sometimes feel that your heart is bounding beyond all possible control, and that can be quite stressful. You've got to take it slow and don't be hubristic about it.
And go with somebody else. Tanya, we're going to talk about water in so many other aspects in just a second, but are you a swimmer as well?
I never regret a swim.
Never regret a swim. Now, Tanya Kovacs, you're a very well-known artist from Devon, and you have been obsessed by water all your artistic life, and probably all your life. And indeed, you have collected water from rivers around England and put that on display. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, that's a piece that's housed at Jupiter Artland, just outside of Edinburgh. And I collected water from 100 rivers. So water that isn't normally kind of close to itself. I brought it to one place. I made a boathouse to house this water collection. And that's sited over
water. But it all looks the same, presumably.
It all looks the same. But I suppose there are many different rivers, but they're all the point is to kind of bring them into confluence and to think about water as a connecting element in the landscape, and that all these different waters are still one water.
And yet, presumably, there are subtle chemical differences between waters from different rivers.
There are, because water is the great kind of solvent in the landscape, as well as the great sculptor in the landscape. It forms the landscape wherever it kind of comes into contact. But I wasn't particularly interested in generating data about the different waters. It wasn't about testing the water or seeing what was in it. It was much more trying to explore how water is this connective element and how we connect to it.
So water is the connective in your art.
Yes.
You've produced a very, very lovely book called Drawing Water, which is some beautiful, beautiful drawings you've made using water and ink. And some water and colour as well. And you're a professor of drawing at Bath Spa. Just tell us a little bit about the difficulty of watercolour.
Well, the difficulty is also it's the reason for carrying on with it.
Because you're not totally in control,
you're
are you?
You're not in control, and that's why I'm drawn to working with it, because I'm prepared to be very patient, because you have to also wait for it to dry to actually know what your drawing is. But I love the idea that I can It's not that I try and draw pictures of riverscapes or seascapes, but I try to draw water and the energy and flow of water. So to work with a material that has that embodied in it really suits the drawing practice. And I'll work with blotting paper sometimes. So there are sort of floods and soaks. And I'll also work with salt, mixing that into it, so I allow evaporation processes to kind of create high tides and low tides within
the
drawings.
Make it sound like huge fun. And you've designed a new water fountain, which is going to be in Admiralty House, I think, is that right?
Yes, I was commissioned by Design Exhibition Scotland to make a drinking water fountain. And I chose to use some of my kind of drawing language and translate that into ceramics. So it's an attempt to kind of highlight the need to reduce the use of single-use plastic in water bottles and celebrate the fact that we share water very easily just by turning the tap on in this country.
So there is a political agenda here. There's another work which looks wonderful. I've not actually seen it in person, called Divers, where you've put concrete into wetsuits and then peeled the wetsuits off, and you have these strange kind of blobby creatures, sort of like Anthony Gormley, if Anthony Gormley's creatures had been eating too many sandwiches and then fallen over.
Well, yes, they are called divers. They're cast concrete into wetsuits, and the wetsuits are very hungry when they expand and expand and expand. And wetsuits are what we need, or I need certainly, when I get into cold water. They're a skin we use to be in an element that isn't quite our own element. And I think they kind of also relate to the silky myth for me as well, and the idea of putting on skin.
The silky myth is the Scottish myth, that you don't understand it, of female water creatures coming in and doing all sorts of extraordinary things on land. Just before I open this up, in the book, Drawing Water, you use drawings of water or seascapes by all sorts of people. Cartographers, there's maps there, there's whale hunters, whalers, there's shipbuilders. Why bring in such a wide range of art into a book about water?
Well, I don't think drawing belongs specifically to artists, and I'm as interested in the drawings that are made by very many different kind of disciplines, because I think drawing is our thinking, it's our visual literacy, which is why it's so important. And I love the way different drawings and different codes of drawing can communicate, I think, easily with each other. So I celebrate that kind of cross-disciplinary nature of the form.
David Lerner, you started as an engineer. Is drawing important to you?
Drawing is vital for engineers, you know. And yeah. It's the step up from just bodging stuff together to actually plan it. I wondered if I could just tell you that we've been linking art to the culvert to Bradford Beck. So because they're so unknown to the whole population of Bradford, we decided we'd mark the course of the main culvert through Bradford. So we had a poetry competition, and we got an amazing response. We got a beautiful poem, which is, well, I shan't try and tell it to you. And then we got it carved by Pat Wall onto a series of pavement plaques, which are now set out.
So you can follow the Beck through the city.
So you can follow the Beck, yes.
I wondered if you thought that drawing can be taught, because I'm just useless at drawing, and the idea of especially drawing something as sort of fluid and difficult as water intimidates me.
Well, I don't tend to teach drawing skills, but I do teach drawing practice, because I think it's like something you just have to do again and again and again. And I think if you kind of don't focus so much on the outcome, but focus on the experience of actually making the drawing, you will just be doing it.
Okay, that's Edward. Comforting.
I was interested in the water fountain that you're making. So I think there's an argument that the provision of water in a city is a basic civic good. It's a mark of civilization, which we've slightly lost since we all started carrying little plastic bottles around.
And I think many cities have very beautiful architectural sort of monuments, which are public water drinking fountains. We used to have to share our provision of water much more before it was domesticated and brought into the home and separated for each house. And they've all been switched off because there are liability questions, like whose water is it, how hygiene, what anxiety. But I suppose there has been a cultural shift with that recently.
I noticed in North Italy, where I was recently, there's lots of sort of civic water places where you can take your own bottles and fill up with sometimes fizzy, sometimes non-fizzy, but clear, cold water. And therefore, they've radically cut the use of plastic bottles. It's the kind of thing that hasn't happened here, but might. More important, however, is the use of art as a sort of political and environmental tool, because it seems to me there's a huge, overwhelming anxiety at the moment about what's happening to the climate and therefore to flooding and so forth. And art is a way of thinking about this that isn't totally catastrophic.
Well, I think it's... I'm not naive. I don't think that art can stop the climate crisis, but I think it can give us new ways to think about it and certainly keep it very much on the agenda, and both in very kind of conscious ways and in unconscious ways, because our relationship with this crisis has entered our imaginations as much as it's entered our consciousness, as your book points to as well.
It hasn't quite entered our politics, has it? I mean, despite the best efforts of the Green Party and lots of politicians who've been talking about this, thinking again about Edward's book, The Great Flood, you would think this would be one of the central things in the election campaign, but it's still pushed to one side again and again and again. Why do you think that is, Edward?
Well, Peter Ackroyd says in his book about the Thames that every flood is forgotten until the next one. So there's a kind of collective amnesia about flooding, which I attributed speculatively to the flood myths. We've always told these stories about flooding. We're used to the idea that the planet floods.
Eventually the ark lands on Ararat and the waters recede and all is well.
And then, exactly, the Noah story is actually a comic story. It has a happy ending, and the dove and so on. These are all positive symbols. And people, I think, find it hard to accept that this time might be different. There might not be a happy ending available anymore.
But also because dealing with floods, as some of the discussion we've had here today, is very complicated. The instinct is to dredge a river, which makes virtually no difference, to build a wall, which just forces the flood onto the next person. Mm. The solutions are much more complicated and subtle, like making the land absorb the water better, and doing all sorts of things, or moving the houses off the floodplain. And those are so difficult to do for anybody.
And like many issues with climate change, you always think it's happening somewhere else as well. Mm-hmm. And that goes for the flood as well, that even though we see it for a couple of days in our media, and then we move on, and unless it's happening to you, you don't think about it. And that's a massive problem for the climate crisis that we face, because we keep thinking they're happening somewhere else.
It strikes me that presumably an issue is that the politicians are not really dealing with this because they don't think that they're going to reap the dividends in the short term, right? And so if you do impose very good sort of policy with regarding flooding, that we'll be reaping the rewards in 10 years, 20 years, and these things are extremely expensive. So you're always having to make a difficult choice as a politician.
You're absolutely right, except we have now been told that the timescale has changed, and we have now been told 10 years. And that is the kind of horizon that should come within the purview of a politician, but doesn't seem to.
And as your book reminds us, we are all the survivors of a flood, in the sense that Doggerland, this vast, vast territory between, or what is now the German Sea, or the North Sea, whatever we call it, that's where we all come from, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all very expensive. So I was seconded into the Department of Environment for a while and did some work on urban runoff. And I did a rough calculation which suggested that to stop all the runoff from roads and houses getting into flooding would cost £100 billion.
Wow.
To retrofit Britain to absorb this water from the existing properties.
Mm. And that's sort of double HS2. Yeah.
And then you have to uproot, close off and move entire villages and communities and roads.
But I would say we can't afford not to.
Mm. Yeah, and the consciousness is changing. I mean, Extinction Rebellion, I think, are a wonderful thing. And there's a very prominent role for art within that.
Yes. I mean, they have, there's really powerful ways that you can impact on people through visual messages, the arts, culture, those sorts of things, you know, that can kind of slip around the side of politics. But we all still have votes, so.
Yes.
I would say, though, I mean, while there's not been a huge surge in support for, say, the Green Party in the way that Germany has had, that I, you know, the Labour Party has taken climate very seriously, and that its manifesto is pretty impressive and bold on climate. So I do think, while we're not necessarily
I've got to be very, very careful not to have to go through all the parties' manifestos on the environment in an election campaign. There's lots of stuff on that.
Yeah.
However, is the rather doleful or pessimistic conclusion that we need an even bigger real flood to go on for longer before we actually change direction as a country?
There are signs of optimistic signs. I mean, you mentioned Doggerland. I went out on a boat to a wind farm in Doggerland, which is built on the flooded land where we used to live. And that was an extraordinary piece of engineering. And these things are emerging all around the country, all around the world, all around the coast. And renewable energy is now becoming commercially viable. And that's
we are changing direction. And just as lots of people are giving up single-use plastics and so on, somehow the stock of starlings is choosing a new direction bit by bit. Mm. Can I ask finally about you were talking about the cost of all of this, and I was asking about the shape of Britain. Are we going to see a country where actually a lot of communities have been physically moved, where there are huge dikes crisscrossing the centre of the country, as well as a changed coastal landscape?
Some places will go. There's a village in Wales that's already been marked for demolition. Some places will certainly go. Large parts of uninhabited land will go. But the predictions remain. I mean, it's difficult to call it.
And so many people are so attached to their location and their house and are so resistant, no matter what the evidence is, that their house will disappear in 5 or 50 years. They won't want to move. It's really, really tough, because we don't do forced migration like the Chinese have done, you know, to build the Three Gorges Dam. They moved however many million of people it was away.
But that wasn't necessarily a sound environmental project itself, of course. When you have a central government which can really do things, quite often it does the really wrong thing.
I would like, in some ways, I like to defend the Chinese, because they are cleaning up their rivers. I've been to Beijing every year for 20 years, and it used to stink in the river, and now it's beautiful.
Well, that's a lovely note to end on, an optimistic note to end on. Thanks to all of you. Leif Arbuthnot, the journalist and cold water swimmer. You can read her frequently in The Times. David Lerner, Emeritus Professor of Environmental Engineering at the University of Sheffield and a proud Bradfordian. The artist Tanya Covert, author of Drawing Water and from Devon. You'll have to wait until next May for her exhibition of Divers. And Edward Platt's The Great Flood, highly recommended, is out now. Now, next week, Kirsty Walk is going to be delving into the world of numbers, nightmares and nanotech. Lots of alliteration there, but now, thank you and goodbye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thank you for downloading the Start the Week podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4.
There's more information about Start the Week on the programme's website. Go to bbc.co.uk, where you'll also find many more Radio 4 programmes you can download for free.
Hi, excuse the interruption. I'm Hugh Dennis, and I'd like to tell you about the Radio 4 Christmas Appeal. Over its long history, listeners have supported St Martin in the Fields and helped thousands of people away from homelessness and into a safe and secure place to live. How? Well, all over the UK, emergency grants of up to £350 help people to pay a deposit on a flat or pay rent arrears to avoid eviction. Frontline workers offer encouragement and challenge so people aren't alone while they get their lives back together. And in London, the connection at St Martin's helps people off the streets and to find a home. Please support the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields by donating online on the Radio 4 website. If you want to hear how your support is helping, you can go to BBC Sounds and listen to a programme all about the Christmas Appeal called Making a Difference with Asma Mir. Whether you're a long-standing donor or this is your first year, thank you. Home starts here.